suitably caffeined and sugared. I hope you've got what needs to get, you've got on board what needs to get you to lunch. The aim of this session is we'll do chapters 1 and 2 before lunch, I hope, and then chapters 3 and 4 in the afternoon after lunch. Very important note, just reaffirmed to me by my colleague John. Notice, do not leave today thinking that racism is a good idea or evangelism is a bad idea, okay? Do not think that for a second. There is no doubt that Jonah is not happy about Assyrian repentance, okay? What I'm suggesting to you is there might be more to it than that. And the more is important. Let me say, you cannot avoid, when you look at this book, you cannot avoid making decisions about what's going on in Jonah's head. You can't avoid it. The information in chapter 4 suggests that loss is part of the anger, the plant thing. We'll do more of that this afternoon. And the data from 2 Kings gives significant reasons why loss might be a factor. Possibilities, not certainties, but there is loss involved in chapter 4, I think. Now, what we're going to do in this session is I'm going to talk you quickly through at chapter 1, and then I'm going to get you to do some work and feedback on chapter 2. So let's dive into chapter 1. We've already touched on what's already going on with Jonah, the unusual situation back home in Israel. Evil king, national sin, and blessing, of which Jonah has been a significant architect. We've touched on the possible causes of his anger: Assyria's gain, personal and national loss. We're going to look at Act 1 of this four-act drama, where interestingly, at the human level, the focus is not really on Jonah. He's very passive in chapter 1. 2 other characters dominate the narrative in chapter 1, and the first is rather unexpected. It is the sea. The sea is everywhere in chapter 1. Verse 4. The Lord hurled a great wind on the sea. Verse 5, the cargo is thrown into the sea. Verse 9, I fear the Lord, the God of heaven who made the sea. Verse 11, the sea grew more and more tempestuous. What will we do to make the sea calm down, they say. Verse 12, pick me up and hurl me into the sea. Verse 13, the sea grew more and more tempestuous. And then verse 15, they hurled him into the sea, and it ceased from its raging. The sea is a major player in chapter 1. Now, folks, this has relatively little impact on us people from Scotland. I mean, what does the sea mean to you? It's the place you go in the summer to try and get a tan but end up getting cold and maybe sunburned if it's a really good day. But for a Hebrew reader, the sea is absolutely loaded with theological freight. Remember Genesis chapter 1? In the beginning, what do we have? Dark, undifferentiated, watery chaos. Into that chaos, God speaks a creative, life-giving word. He brings light and order and life. He separates out the sea, makes distinctions, turns this dark, unformed, watery lump into a beautiful world. And from that point on in the Bible, the sea, though a good thing that God has made, the sea is his, for he made it, says the Psalms, the sea is symbolically loaded with ideas of chaos, uncreation, hostility to God. It's symbolically the opposite of what God's life-giving word produces. And repeatedly then in the poetry of the Bible, especially in Psalms and in Job, the sea, sometimes containing what my former colleague Bob File referred to as the chaos monster, a great swimming monster, the sea and the monster in it is viewed as an enemy of God and of his people and of his creative purposes. And God's mastery over the sea in the Bible belongs uniquely to him. Why? Because he's the creator, that's why. Jonah doesn't just refuse to go to Nineveh. He doesn't just stamp his feet and say, no, I'm staying at home. He heads for the sea. Verse 3, Jonah arose to flee to Tarshish. And the phrase is literally, from before the Lord. Now, folks, Jonah is not a theological idiot. Verse 9, Jonah knows only too well that you cannot run away from God. That is not what he's trying to do here. So what is going on in verse 3? Notice that twice we're told in verse 3 that he goes to Tarshish from before the Lord. That's the phrase. What does that phrase, from before the Lord, mean, signify? Well, turn to 1 Kings 17, please. Here's Elijah, Jonah's very famous predecessor in ministry in the Northern Kingdom. And his introductory words, verse 17, verse 1. Now Elijah the Tishbite of Tishbe in Gilead said to Ahab, as the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, before whom I stand. That before the Lord term is a prophetic term. The prophet stands before the Lord and receives the Lord's direction to pass on to the people. Jonah is not escaping God here. He's abandoning his prophetic role. Twice, from before the Lord, from before the Lord. I've had enough of being a prophet. I think that's what's going on. And instead of profiting, he heads for Tarshish, which is an interesting word. It's a word related to the sea. It's sometimes used of places across the sea, probably not just one place. And it's sometimes used, I think, of the open sea in general. So when you meet in the Old Testament the phrase, the ships of Tarshish, that probably doesn't mean the ships that come from the place Tarshish. It probably means ships that are big enough to go out on the open sea, not just shoreline ships. Jonah the prophet is commanded to preach God's life-giving word to Nineveh. Instead, he abandons his prophetic role and heads for the realm of chaos and uncreation, the sea. It's a bit like the reverse of Genesis chapter 1, Jonah chapter 1. He won't have the word of the Lord, he'd rather have the realm of uncreation and darkness. And God hands him over to that. If you want sea, I'll give you sea. Which is where he finds himself in verse 15, lost in the depths of the sea, facing not life but death. And as chapter 2 makes clear, he is saved from the brink of death in the sea. So what does verse 3 signify? I think it signifies this. God, I absolutely hate your plan. I'd rather have the realm of uncreation than keep speaking your word. Which is it not, precisely what he says in Jonah chapter 4. I'm angry enough to die. I'd rather be uncreated than carry on with doing this job. So Jonah's behaviour in chapter 1, I think, is the physical and spatial expression of the emotion he reveals in chapter 4. Blow this for a lark. If this is what being a prophet involves, uncreation's for me. It's really symbolically loaded. But the true God is effortlessly powerful over chaos and death and sea, and interestingly also the monster in it. Look at verse 17. there is a monster in the sea. But it's not a mythical chaos monster, it's just a fish. And it's God's fish, so it does exactly what God wants it to do. Now, folks, it's just worth a little aside here. It is sometimes very, very hard to believe that God is in total mastery of his creation. Sometimes that's very hard to believe. Wherever you look, you see natural disaster, human tyranny, sickness, and death. Often they seem completely to rule the human experience. It is possible that you come here today, now, absolutely reeling from the power of those things as they've interacted with your own life. Let me assure you that the good God is completely in control of all that he's created. The good God is in control. Of course, like Jonah, from where we're sitting, it so often doesn't appear to be true. It does not appear to Jonah that it's true at this point. And therefore, sometimes God does things which his people, small as we are, and sinful as we are, seem abhorrent to us, just as they did to Jonah. Let me assure you, they will not appear so in the end. They will not. However, at this point in the story, Jonah is quite incapable of seeing that God is in any way right to ask this of him. Now, I take it that the book is here in the Bible because Jonah was in the end able to recognize that his anger was completely misplaced. But he's not in that position at this point in the story. Jonah heads for the sea. Second thing, the second character that's evident in this passage is the sailors. Good guys, the sailors, don't you think? And interestingly, there are two human movements in chapter one. Jonah moves from before the Lord to the depths of the sea. And the sailors move from calling in their God to making offerings to Yahweh. These are both big movements, and they go right beside each other as he goes down. Did you notice the phrase, Jonah went down to? It's repeated all the way through this chapter. Well, as he moves down, sort of theologically and spatially, they move nearer and nearer and nearer and nearer. And their movements are built on three episodes of fear, three things that they're afraid of. Verse 5. They fear the storm. It's a real killer of a storm. And they do all the things you'd expect a person to do. They pray. Very sensible to pray in danger. They throw stuff overboard. Jonah's inactivity absolutely amazes them. And it's such a big storm that they know something's up, so they cast lots to find out what's up. Second thing they fear is they fear Jonah's fear. Look at verse 10. Jonah tells them that the God he's avoiding owns the creation. And they go, "You idiot! What a numbskull you are! If that's the God you're running away from." And they are exceedingly afraid. Which is quite appropriate, really, isn't it? But they still try to do the right thing for Jonah. Verse 14. You know, they row as hard as they can and they throw more stuff overboard. They do everything they can. And notice verse 14. When they realize there's no other course of action open, what do they do in verse 14? They called out to Yahweh, "O Yahweh, let us not perish for this man's life, and lay not on us innocent blood, for you, O Lord, have done as it pleased you." They pray to Yahweh, no longer to their gods, that God would not hold them guilty for throwing this man into the sea. Third thing they fear is Yahweh himself, verse 16. when they throw Jonah into the sea and the sea ceases from its raging, then the men feared Yahweh exceedingly, and they offered a sacrifice to Yahweh and made vows. See what's happening here? Even in Jonah's rebellious movement away from his prophetic role, God uses his prophet. How does he do that? Because his prophet is a creative thing like everything else that he's completely in control of. He uses his prophet to make himself known to those who don't know him. The true God is not only immensely powerful, but immensely compassionate. Why does God, after all, appoint prophets at all? So that people will come to know him, that's why. And so much does he want people to know him, that even as here, when the prophet doesn't want to make him known, he's going to make himself known through the prophet anyway. Now, folks, there's not much time, because we need to get on with chapter 2, but let me ask, how might this story connect with a later audience? I'm going to aim for the rest of this. I'm going to suggest that the southern kingdom probably is the later audience. There's not long left of the northern kingdom after Jeroboam 1. And for reasons that we'll go on to, I think it's had its day. Let me suggest then that this book is probably a book from a northern experience directed towards the south. I'm going to work on that anyway. It's not definite. What might chapter 1 have said to the southern kingdom a bit later on? Well, I think it's quite helpful to think of Jonah as being in himself a bit like a little Israel. He, in certain ways, shares the attitudes of the people he comes from. Just as Jonah was meant to be a privileged prophet of the Lord, so Israel was appointed to be God's servant in the world. Just as Jonah was meant to be God's messenger to Israel, so Israel was supposed to be God's representative in the world. Not in a go out and tell the nations sort of way, but in a light to the nations sort of way. The nations were supposed to look at Israel and see something marvelously distinctive. But Israel had long since abandoned that role, just as in chapter 1, verse 1, Jonah abandons his role. What ruled in Israel, in Judah, in the southern kingdom, and in Israel historically, was an inward-looking, nationalist, self-seeking mindset, focused on national advancement and trusting in political power-breaking to make that happen, rather than focused on being a light to the nations and trusting God's power to make that happen. So what is an Israelite reader back home presented with in chapter 1? On one hand, a privileged and much used prophet who angrily flees from his God-given role. And on the other, a very strong reminder of the greatness of God's power. He really rules everything. And on the generosity of God's mercy, he extends it even to enemies, to the godless, the people who care nothing for him, like these sailors. Jonah is like a little Israel, I think. Back home, there are big attitude issues and big perplexity issues, and they're shared by Jonah. Now, folks, such is the nature of human sinfulness that God's people often have attitude issues. We curve in on ourselves, as Luther puts it, both individually and corporately. And our view of God curves in with that, becomes small. So his concerns become delimited by our concerns. His reach limited to our reach. our wants, our spiritual aspirations even, we think he is there to fulfill those. We have perspective issues. Also, we have perplexity issues in life, don't we? This is a complex, confusing world in which we live. It is. And it's a fallen world, and we are finite and flawed. And so we cannot see from where we stand, from the perspective of creatureliness, we cannot see what the Creator is doing. Can you see what the Creator is doing in your life right now? Of course you can't, you're a creature. And sometimes what the Creator demands of us, or the circumstances the Creator brings to us, are deeply perplexing. Now, it's very easy for us to buy into a kind of soft prosperity gospel as Christians. Not, you know, you don't expect that if we serve the Lord, we'll get a shiny suit and a nice personal jet. Not that kind of thing. But we do think, don't we, if we're not careful, that if we serve the Lord, life ought to be relatively straightforward, relatively calm. Our families, relatively stable. Our death, relatively peaceful. And the trouble is, when something really big and fat and unsettling lands on our porch, we think, for why you do this? This was not in the game. So common to do that, isn't it? Why is that? It's because we are creatures and the Creator is doing things that we're completely unaware of. Brothers and sisters, the Creator will use every perplexing thing in your life in the end for your good and his glory. Everything. I mean, it's almost unimaginable, that, isn't it? Can you imagine on the last day when the Lord Jesus returns, being able to look back on the whole of history and the whole of your life and say with the deepest conviction, you have done everything brilliantly. Can you imagine that? It's unimaginable, isn't it? But that's the picture the Bible holds out to us of the brilliance of what the creation is doing in his created order. The trouble is we're just very small and flawed and creaturely, and we cannot see what he's doing. And so life is full of perplexity and full of confusion and difficulty. Why does the Southern Kingdom need to hear that? Because they've got very perplexing issues, and their view of God has become very small, very small. And their view of their role in the world has become very small. But God is much bigger than that. So a big reminder of the Creator and his power and his kindness in chapter 1. Okay, this brings us on to chapter 2. Now, I'm going to get you to do some work now, because it's no good you falling asleep. Chapter 2, we're on number 7. In chapter 2, we get Jonah's prayer from the belly of the fish. Great place to play, the belly of a fish, isn't it? I want you to read Jonah's prayer and discuss the following. Number 1, if you had to divide this prayer into sections, how would you do that? How does it divide up? What are the things going on? Number 2, we've just observed that chapter 1 has got two parallel movements. Jonah to the sea, the sailors towards Yahweh. What movements can you see in chapter 2? Third, do you think this is an orthodox prayer? Is it true? And 4, does anything surprise you about it? Okay, go talk. Okay, folks, can I ask, are you done or do you need another couple of minutes? Hands up for another couple of minutes. Hands up for done. All right, you're done. Okay, you're mostly done. All right, good. Okay, let's dive into it. Let me ask you first about the movements. What do you think about the movements in this prayer? Anyone? Yep. Yes. Yeah, good. So it's a down and up prayer, isn't it? You threw me in. You dragged me out. Let's just highlight those. You cast me into the deep, verse 3. And where is it? You brought up my life from the pit. That's a little bit of musical accompaniment. Does that mean? Excuse me, what is that? What is that? Let's just turn the sound down. I've no idea where that's coming from. Okay, I've switched off my sound. Just ignore that for a moment. Okay, just listen to me, not to that, okay? So notice there's a, you threw me into the sea, you brought me out of the sea. That's the big movement in it.
Is
that? That's a musical accompaniment to his little with his little song. Yes. Okay. I think it divides up like this. I think first we get an introduction. I called out to the Lord out of my distress, and He answered me. Out of the belly of Sheol I cried, and You heard my voice. I think that's a kind of summary of what happens. Then there's a You threw me in, and a You pulled me out bit. And then I think there's a concluding bit at the end. A summary. Those who pay regard to vain idols forsake their hope of steadfast love. But I, with the voice of thanksgiving, will sacrifice to You. Notice the centrality of the temple. Both of the movements have a temple-related statement in them. So, verse... That really is perplexing, isn't it? So, verse 4, thank you there. The Holy Temple in verse 4. And then again in verse... Into Your Holy Temple. So I think there's an introduction, a You threw me down, You threw me in, and You pulled me up, and a summary at the end. Now let me ask you, do you think this is this an orthodox prayer? What do you think? Amy doesn't think so?
What do you mean by orthodox?
I mean, is it true? Is it theological? Is it theologically true in Old Testament terms? Forget its setting for a moment. Is it theologically true in Old Testament terms?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Actually.
Yes, good. I think if you wrenched this out of its setting and stuck it in the book of Psalms, you wouldn't be all that surprised. Is it a good thing to trust in vain idols in the Old Testament? No. Is it a good thing to pray towards God in His temple and trust in Him? Yeah, really good thing. So I think on its own, out of context, it's true, but here's the issue, the context. Now, let me just, on to B, a structural issue, and therefore a question about chapter 2. The four acts of this book focus in on four responses to God. The sailors in chapter 1, Jonah in chapter 2. The people of Nineveh and the king in chapter 3, Jonah in chapter 4. It goes pagans, Jonah, pagans, Jonah. Which invites, does it not, comparison between the pagans on one hand, who do really well in this book, really well, and Jonah, who definitely in chapter 4 isn't doing all that well. So here's the question. Is chapter 2 expressing the same mindset as chapter 4, or something different? In other words, does he move from thankfulness in chapter 2 to fuming rage in chapter 4? Or is there common ground between the mindsets of chapter 2 and chapter 4? Do you see that? The structure of the book kind of necessitates that sort of question. It appears at first glance to be a big shift, doesn't it? Very grateful in chapter 2, very angry in chapter 4. Has he just flipped, or is there some common ground? So, what I would like you to do, please, for 5 minutes or so, is compare chapter 2 and what's just happened in chapter 1. In other words, set this prayer in its context and ask yourself, how does it look when you put it next to chapter 1? So, talk about that for a few minutes, please. Order. Order. Very quickly, folks. Quick responses. Comparing, contrasting with chapter 1. Any interesting things found? Somebody yell. Quick.
We thought it was interesting how he says in chapter 2, verse 3, "For you cast me into the deep." And actually, in chapter 1, he says to the sailors, "Pick me up and hurl me into the sea."
Yeah.
Feels like Jonah cast himself into the deep rather than.
Yeah. I think in chapter 2 he recognises that God is behind it, as he does in chapter 1, but you're quite right. That's right. Good. Anything else?
Verse 4 says he's driven away from his
side,
and it seems like he's run away.
Yes, he's run away. Good. That's an interesting way to put it. Yes, good. Good. Excellent.
But he did end up sacrificing and bowing to
make sailors. Yes. Interestingly, both chapter 1 and his prayer in chapter 2 end on the same note, that of sacrificing vows, to making vows to the Lord and sacrificing. So they end in the same place. Very good.
Verse 2 says, he says, he called out.
Yep.
The sailors that called out.
The sailors called out, he called out. Good, excellent.
Chapter 1, he's in the bailing of the ship, and he's quite at peace still.
Yes.
In chapter 2, he's in the belly of the fish.
Yes.
He's trying.
Not quite such a peaceful place. Two bellies, that's right. Interesting. So notice there's lots of compare and contrast. Yep.
It's in verse 9 where Jonah says salvation belongs to the Lord.
Yep.
Indicates that he understands that God is sovereign.
Yep.
In salvation, and
yep,
will show his mercy upon whom he is.
Yeah.
And yet Jonah doesn't seem to be able to.
But yes. Yes, good. Salvation belongs to the Lord. But do I share that really concern? That concern really? Good. Very good. Okay, there's loads of compare and contrasting going on. I want to just, as we get towards the end a bit, I want to mention four things about the prayer that are surprising given its context. Wrench it out of its context, and I think it could belong comfortably in the Psalms. You know, unnamed danger from which God rescued, I will vow to you. What a brilliant thing it is to know Yahweh and not be a pagan. That's the kind of spirit of it. You could put that in the Psalms, but in context, there are four things that I think are really strange. Number one, elegant liturgy in the belly of a fish? Really? It's a very tidy prayer, this, isn't it? It's elegant. It's carefully structured. I have a little introduction. I have two movements, both ending in your temple. I have a summary at the end about how brilliant knowledge of Yahweh is and how terrible it is to be a pagan. It's very tidily put, isn't it? Now, I don't know what being in the belly of a fish is quite like, but I imagine words like this would be the last thing that I would articulate. Coughing, spluttering, where's the next breath going to come from? It's interestingly expressed, isn't it? And notice it's positioned as the words that he spoke in the belly of the fish to the Lord his God. Um, sometimes the Bible feels, Bible narrative feels a bit like musicals, you know, people are just bursting into song at, you know, at any opportunity. But very importantly, usually in the Bible, when songs or poems are in the middle of narrative, they say something really significant, illustrating what's going on in the narrative. So here's a suggestion. I wonder if this is Jonah writing later on, describing his mindset, theologically speaking, at the point of rescue. Notice, the book isn't written at the point of rescue, is it? The book is written later. What could one say about this book, about this expression? Well, it's theologically orthodox on its own. Now, folks, this is important because if this is an expression of his theological mindset at the time of rescue, then it contributes very significantly to the overall picture of what's going on in his book. That is to say, it may not be all that far removed from the anger in chapter 4. Is this the theology that drives the anger of chapter 4? More of that in a moment. These words have an air of calm reflection about them which don't quite fit for fish belly experience, I don't think. But I suspect they're deliberately there for a purpose, to express to us where he was theologically. Second, notice how God gets the praise, but Jonah is the really active player in these words. God gets the praise, but Jonah is the really active player. In this poem, Jonah refers to the Lord a number of times. Verse 2, the Lord hears and answers his cry. Verse 3, you held me in. Verse 6, you brought up my life. Verse 9, salvation comes from the Lord. He mentions God and God's activity, for which he's thankful. However, notice the I, me, and my words. I called to the Lord out of my distress. He answered me. I cried. You heard my voice. You cast me into the deep. The flood surrounded me. All your waves and your billows passed over me. I am driven away, yet I shall again look. The waters closed in over me to take my life. The deep surrounded me. My head, I went down to the land. Bars closed upon me. You brought up my life. When my life was fainting away, I remembered. My prayer came to you. I, with the voice of thanksgiving, will sacrifice to you. What I have vowed, I will pay. There are active verbs used of Yahweh in this psalm. There are. And again, out of context, that wouldn't be strange. But most of the active verbs talk about what Jonah has done. I called, verse 4. I said, verse 7. I remembered, verse 9. I will praise. Now again, there's nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with that. You find plenty of I's and me's and my's in the Psalms, but it's interesting, isn't it? Yeah, God was the rescuer, but I prayed, I called, and God rescued me, and I will be giving my vows to God at the end. Interesting, isn't it? Third, do you notice how he admits his danger, but crucially, I think, in context, he does not admit his disobedience in these words? Now, I mentioned before there are a good number of psalms quite like this in their basic form. Psalms of thanksgiving after deliverance of some sort of danger. I say some sort of danger because often in those psalms the danger is not specified clearly, tightly. It's just a bad thing happened, the Lord rescued me, I cried to him and he was really good to me. I'm really thankful for that. This poem looks like that. But his disobedience in chapter 1 for a prophet has been really gross, hasn't it? Jonah's predicament is not some random undeserved mishap. Yes, he admits in the prayer that God threw him in to the sea. But he's a prophet and he's been used by God back home in Israel, but he'd rather die than be used by God going to Nineveh. His actions towards God have been those of an enemy, not of a prophet. And that's what makes his prayer so odd. For though the prayer does recognize God's hostility, verse 3, you hurled me in, is there any acknowledgement of his role, his disobedience, his abandoning of his prophetic role anywhere in those words? I think not. The poem goes, this was a very bad situation that God brought me into. I prayed to him and he rescued me. I'm very thankful for that. Where's his part in the drama? Given the situation, don't you think that's odd? He admits his danger, but not his disobedience. And, crucially, fourth, he compares himself favourably to the pagans. Verse 7. When my life was ebbing away, I remembered you, Lord, and my prayer rose to you, to your holy temple. Those who cling to worthless idols turn away from God's love. But I, with shouts of grateful praise, will sacrifice to you. Let me put it in ESV. Those who pray regard to vain idols forsake their hope of steadfast love. Really? What happened in chapter 1? Those who pay regard to vain idols at the beginning of chapter 1 experience God's steadfast love in the chapter. But I, with the voice of sacrificing, thanksgiving, will sacrifice to you. What I have vowed, I will pay. Those pagans up there who threw me in, they just call to their gods. Steadfast love, not for people like that. But I, do you see the comparison there? Those pagan types. But I'm not like them. Now I think all of these things are very odd. One, the sophisticated orthodox theological formulation. Number two, that he is the active player. But number three, he does not recognize his disobedience in his active playing. And fourth, he compares himself favourably with the pagans. I think if you take it out of his context, it's fine. But stick it in his context, one of gross disobedience, and it's completely inappropriate in so many ways. And what I think Jonah is doing here is he's saying, this is the kind of mindset I inhabited back then at that point. Now, if Jonah is like a little Israel, let's just run with that idea at the moment. Do you think Yahweh might be getting the praise in Israel? There's been military advance. Jonah the prophet is the agent of that advance. Do you think Yahweh might be getting some praise back in Israel? Well, it's possible, isn't it? However, do you think Jonah might be center stage in Israel? A key player? Do you think Israel's national mindset at this point is a mindset of humility? Or of, look at what the king is doing. Look at the battles he's fighting. Look at the peace we're enjoying. Look at the prosperity. How good we're doing. do you think that Israel admits her danger but not her disobedience? Do you think there's a problem with non-admission of disobedience back home? Absolutely there is. A massive problem nationally of non-admission of disobedience. For they are thoroughly attached to the sins of Jeroboam the son of Nebat. We have golden calves here. That's the religious setting of life back in Israel, back home. Jonah is quick to mention the temple and his prayers to the temple. Why? Because he's Orthodox. He knows that's a problem. But back home, life is going on, prosperous, happy, with golden calves, the thing which made everything nearly fall over right at the beginning. Massive unrepented of sin back home. And three, Jonah thinks he's better than the sailors, better than the pagans. What does Israel back home think, do you think? Better than those northern Arameans whose gods we're now obviously superior to because we're winning territory back. Better than that horrible big dog Assyria in the background, because look at them now. They're not doing anything big. We're the big players now. Do you get the feel for that? I suspect what we've got here is his mindset, but that mindset reflects the national mindset back home. In one sense, Orthodox, but in massive denial about A, the fact that Yahweh has brought to them the good they've had, B, the fact that they are grossly disobedient and don't deserve a thing of the good things that God has done to them, and C, the fact that they are therefore just folks. Look at the words. Those who pay regard to vain idols forsake their hope of steadfast love. Who is paying attention to vain idols? Answer, his nation is. Now I'm sure he's aware that he has not been able to turn that round. I'm sure he's aware of that. He's not deluding himself that things are better than they are back home. But I think at this point he's comparing himself to the pagans and the ship, not thinking quite so actively about what's going on back home. So let me suggest to you that here is Jonah's mindset that issues forth in the kind of anger that we see in this book. That here is Jonah's giving us where he was theologically in comparison to pagans. And I think that that mindset is the cause of the anger. It's his theological presuppositions. Now, what summary words would you use to describe that mindset? Let's have a few summary adjectives.
A Pharisee?
Self-congratulatory. Good. Thank you. That's helpful.
Arrogant.
Yes.
Presumptuous.
Presumption is a really good word, I think, for this. Presumption. We're okay. I'm okay. We're in the theological good camp here. Good. Any others? Well, folks, that's very good, I think. I think that's all very good. I think what we get here is the mindset. Here is the mindset that drives the response. And I take it that that reflects significantly the mindset back home. In Israel. He's like a little Israel in certain ways. Not, I think, in every way. I think it would be stupid to think that he thinks the golden calf thing is a good idea. That would be really stupid to think that. If he's a proper prophet, he must know that's a problem. So not in every way, but in significant ways, I think he shares Israel's mindset. Folks, we've got 5 minutes for questions before lunch. Anybody want to ask any questions or make any comments? Yes, sir.
The story of Jonah is told clearly by Jonah.
I think so.
Story.
Yeah.
Or must be, because it tells you what the sailors then after he was going to the sea. And that can only come from a story.
Yeah.
and therefore it must be told as a parable.
Yeah.
And so he's clearly wanting us to see himself in these roles, but he's clearly also wanting the people trying for to see himself in these
roles.
But I'm kind of thinking about the way that Jesus interprets the story as well, saying that, you know, this is the sign for you, the sign of Jonah. And, you know, at various points, Jesus goes off over the sea to go and see the people in the next chapter 4.
Indeed.
Yeah,
indeed.
Even the Lord himself. And, you know, and his disciples come and say, well, what do you mean, you see?
And
he stills the storm, but he stills the storm because he's on his way to the,
yeah, good. Okay, we will look briefly at both of those later on in the day, but it's very helpful to think about that. What are the New Testament pickups of this? The sign of Jonah, I think we probably won't spend much time with that in this afternoon. I think the sign of Jonah is a back from the dead preacher. As Jonah was 3 days in the belly of the whale, so the Son of Man. I think the sign that Jesus gives to his hostile interlocutors at that point is no sign except a back from the dead preacher. They're going to get a back from the dead preacher, just as Jonah is in effect a back from the dead preacher to Nineveh. He's from the place of the dead to be a preacher. The Mark 4 is really interesting. The calming of the storm episode, we will look at that later on, because there is a serious Jonah 1 thing going on there in the calming of the storm episode in Mark chapter 1. And it's really interesting to ask, well, why on earth at this point in Mark's gospel is there a Jonah 1 kind of thing? I mean, in what sense is Mark, is Jesus anything like Jonah? Or this situation anything like Jonah's? Yeah, we'll pick up on that at greater length this afternoon. Thanks, that's really helpful. Any others? Yes?
When there's such a beautiful, exilical, pre-exilical allegory.
Yeah.
How do you deal with people to say, well, that's what this is, it's not going to be something that happened, it's a beautiful allegory for Israel rather than something that happened to Jonah literally?
Well, I think the straightest line to that would be Jesus speaks as though it's a historical episode. I think that would be the straightest reading of that. I also think actually it fits really well into the running story of pre-destruction Northern Kingdom, and we'll come on to that a bit this afternoon.
So you don't have to give ground on the happening just because the allegory also works, or the metaphor to the Northern Kingdom works. You don't have to then say, well, it's either Northern Kingdom.
No, I don't. I think that the story works as a story for later Israel to read itself into doesn't mean it didn't happen.
Yeah,
absolutely. No, I think that's really helpful. Yeah. Good. Any others? In that case, lunch.